Financial support for WICN and programs like Inquiry come from listeners like yourself. So plan to take a moment out to consider becoming a member now by pledging online to WICN at wicn.org. Thank you. Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My special guest tonight is Scott Yanow, who has been writing about jazz since 1975. All the major jazz magazines, penned 750 sets of liner notes, reviewed more jazz CDs than anyone in history, and we're talking about his latest book, The Great Jazz Guitarists, The Ultimate Guide. Scott.
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Why, thanks for having me.
You really mean the ultimate guide. I have to say this. This is an amazing guide. First of all, there's a concise history of the jazz guitar. Then there's 342 great jazz guitarist biographies, 175 other jazz guitarists. Then a list. I love this. They also play jazz guitar. Then jazz guitarists on film, 10 memorable in brief appearances by jazz guitarists in Hollywood films. And then I love this, the best ghosting by a jazz guitarist. Holy smokes.
Well, I had a week free, so I said,
I just get the feeling this is the way you do it. If you're going to do it, you might as well go all the way out. Am I right?
Well, I want to include everybody.
I want to mention Jimi Hendrix is in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me. What you have to talk about why.
Well, because Jimi Hendrix was an influence on some jazz musicians, particularly ones in the early fusion days, and he's been an inspiration to some of the avant-garde guitarists who have come up since then, too.
That's right. Now, I want to talk about the history. There's a really fine history in the beginning of this book, and one of the first things you start out by saying, and I want to talk about it and elaborate on this, is that the guitar has always had an odd position in the jazz world. Elaborate on that.
Well, the guitar had to basically win three different battles. At first, in the 1920s, it could barely be heard at all on records, so it actually had to fight against the banjo. And the banjo was actually used on most jazz recordings up until about the mid-20s, just because the guitar couldn't be heard. It wasn't picked up by the recording devices. Now, once the recording techniques improved, then the guitar became more a part of jazz, but it still couldn't really be heard as a soloist very much in the 20s, you know, second half of the 20s and the 30s, unless it was in a string group like Django Reinhardt's group, or if it was pretty much isolated like Eddie Lang, who sometimes would record with just a piano player. But if you had a larger band, the guitar was really felt more than heard. And so it won that battle to be heard. It didn't really win it until the electric guitar became, in the late 30s became more popular, and it started to take over. And then after that, Charlie Christian was a major influence on so many different guitarists for about a 20-year period that it was really not until the late 60s that other different styles of guitar became more popular.
I want to spend a moment, because this is something I didn't know, was the history of banjo and jazz. And as you mentioned, it was basically used instead of a guitar because it could be heard. Why is that?
Well, banjo is just a louder metallic instrument, really.
And it's got to do with the technology of recording at the time, too.
Yeah. That and just in general, before microphones were really that well developed, the guitar just, it would just be like inaudible, pretty much.
Now, is this basically during the ragtime era?
Yeah, well, even during the ragtime era, there were actually a couple of banjo soloists who were pretty well known, but there weren't any guitarists. You know, even though in live concerts, in live performances, the guitar was used, but not really on records.
Now, I want to talk about two of the leading artists, if you can just fill in some biographical details, Fred Van Epps and Wes Ussman. Who were they?
Well, those are the two. It's funny in a way because when people think of ragtime, they think of it as being as piano music. And, of course, it was. But on records, the piano wasn't really picked up all that well. So those two banjoists recorded quite a few ragtime solos, a lot more than piano players of the time period.
Now let's talk about some of the great jazz guitarists historically. Eddie Lang, 1925. Now, as you mentioned, there were other jazz guitarists before him, but what's special about Eddie Lang?
Well, he was a virtuoso, Eddie Lang, and he was very very versatile. He could pop up in a lot of different settings. He could play behind a commercial singer and uplift the whole session. So, you know, he was really just the first one. And he was really pretty important in when he came up, it helped the guitar replace the banjo, because by then recording techniques were getting better, and also a lot of people were being influenced by the way he played.
He began his guitar, and thank God for your book, he began his career as a violinist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what he played originally. In fact, he and his boyhood friend, Joe Venuti, were both violinists, and then when he switched to guitar, you know, they still continued playing together as a violin-guitar duo.
And now, in 1932, he became Bing Crosby's regular accompanist.
Yeah, Eddie Lang probably would have had a pretty lucrative and long career, but unfortunately he died the following year.
And the way he died of a botched tonsillectomy in 1933? That's like virtually unheard of now.
Oh, of course. Well, that happened to a piano player band leader, Benny Moulton, also around the same time period. Well, medicine has improved a bit since then.
Wow. Now, let's talk about this top soloist in 1930s, obviously. And the one I think that everybody's going to remember is Django Reinhardt. Talk to me about the gypsy jazz movement for people who aren't familiar with it.
Well, the gypsy jazz movement was based... Django Reinhardt's pretty much of a unique figure in jazz history on a couple of different levels. You know, first, in the 30s, he was became the first significant European jazz musician, and he was the top guitarist, particularly after Eddie Lang died. Throughout the 30s, he played with a very powerful force, even though he was playing acoustic guitar. Of course, in his group, it was comprised of Stefan Grappelli on violin, three acoustic guitars, and a string bass, so you could hear the guitar. But even when he recorded with a big band, you could hear him. He just was very loud, considering that it was acoustic. And Django Reinhardt, actually, not too many people really realize, but in his later years, which was by the late 40s, he was one of the top electric guitarists in jazz, and he was also a master of bebop, even though he's pretty much just remembered for playing acoustic in swing groups. And after he died in the early 50s, his style of music was pretty much overlooked for a few decades, but in the mid to late 70s, it made a comeback as gypsy jazz. And suddenly there were all these different guitarists, particularly in Europe, who sound like Django Reinhardt. That's still true today.
The amazing thing about him is that he was physically handicapped. He could never use the fourth and fifth fingers of his left hand. What happened?
Well, he was in a fire in his gypsy caravan. Artificial flowers caught on fire, and for a short time they actually thought that his hand was going to have to be amputated, but his friend snuck him out of the hospital and he recovered. But it's just that the hand that he used to finger the guitar, he could only use two of the fingers. So the little bit of film that there is of him, it's pretty amazing to watch, because he does manage to make up for the three fingers he couldn't use.
So how did he do chords?
Just played very fast. I think sometimes he would hold two strings down with one finger.
Wow. Now, he also had something weird happening to him during World War II.
Well, he managed to survive. He lived in occupied Europe during World War II. He made the mistake, although he thought it was the right thing to do, when World War II started, he and Stefan Grappelli and their group were in England, but he just came back to France, even though France was occupied. And the Germans tried their best to use him, but they didn't really have much luck. He kept on escaping and, you know, just kind of wandering away like he did in real life. So he managed to survive the World War II years and actually did a fair amount of recordings during that time period.
Now, Scott, before we get back to the guitars, I got to talk to you about how you put together a book like this that is so all-encompassing and it's just got so much information, and I know you're used to it, but I need to hear about the process. How do you even start a book like this?
Well, if I decide what the idea is going to be, which in this case was a jazz guitarist, I want to, of course, make sure that I include everybody who's possible. So I went through discographies and a lot of different books just to make sure that I wouldn't leave anybody out. Even so, there's always a couple that get left out, and you know, as I say in the book, I know full well that a month after it's published, it's going to be some great guitarist that pops up somewhere. But I did my best to cover everybody up to, say, let's say 3 years ago. And then from then on, it's just a matter of just looking everybody up and just using the knowledge I have and making lists of who should be in the book and who's going to be in what section.
Because of your long writing career in jazz, I have to believe there are people gunning for you when you come out with a book like this. Like, who did you forget? And then they immediately let you know. Am I right?
Oh, of course. But that everybody does that because that's part of it. If it's called The Great Jazz Guitarist, I have to make sure I include every great one.
This is your personal list, right? When you list the 342 great jazz guitarists, this is your list.
Of course. Well, yeah, no one else had this particular list.
Okay. Now, I have to ask you about, before we move on, the best ghosting by a jazz guitarist. Who is it?
Well, you know, I always liked the movie Sweet and Lowdown, the Woody Allen movie, and Howard Alden filled in for the lead guitarist, who was Sean Penn. You know, Sean Penn actually fingered the guitar pretty accurately, but he's not playing on it.
And that's like this. There's only, you know, what I was surprised. Is that the only case, or was just the best case?
Well, it's the only one I could think of. Yeah, because jazz guitars have not been the stars of too many movies, so that was a logical one.
The only one I can think of is, what's the one with Burt Lancaster and The Sweet Smell of Success, where what's his name, who's not in the band, is actually the jazz guitarist.
Yeah, Martin
Mull? No, not Martin Mull. Martin Mull's the comedian. It's the guy who was in Route 66, too.
Oh, I'm not sure. But, I know Jim Hall was in the band at the time, but so he was the one that was ghosting.
Let's talk about Charlie Christian. Let's talk about what he accomplished and some of the things he did. You'd call him the Charlie Parker of guitar. Talk about that.
Well, I believe, you know, the history of the guitar changed drastically when he came. In fact, you could really look at the history of the guitars pre-Charlie Christian and post-Charlie Christian, because he was the first great electric guitarist. He wasn't the first one, because he was preceded by a couple other people a year or two earlier, but he basically he formed and came up with the vocabulary of the electric guitar,
right,
at least for the next 20, 30 years. His phrases have been used by so many other guitarists since then. You know, everybody from Bonnie Kessel and Herb Ellis to George Benson and Tal Follo and Wes Montgomery, all of them would have said that they basically came from Charlie Christian. And he did all this in about a 2.5-year period, because he wasn't around all that long.
Now, you're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Scott Yanna, who has been writing about jazz since 1975 for all the major jazz magazines. He's penned 750 sets of liner notes. He has reviewed more jazz CDs than anyone in history. And we're talking about his book, his latest book, The Great Jazz Guitarists, The Ultimate Guide. And it is as advertised. Les Paul. We got to talk about Les Paul. The thing, whenever I think about and talk about Les Paul, it's just this incredible list of accomplishments. And for people who aren't familiar, let's talk about what Les Paul did.
Les Paul will probably always be best known for his multi-track recordings. He wasn't the first one to do that, but he was the innovator on it. He really extended it. His records as Les Paul and Mary Ford that he made with his wife often have him playing up to a dozen guitars, you know, overdubbed, and his wife singing about five or six different voices. So he was very innovative that way. He was an inventor of an awful lot of guitars, especially rock ones, use the Les Paul
model. Oh, yeah.
But the real reason he's in the book beyond that is just that he was a great jazz guitarist. He played a lot of different styles in his career, but whenever he played jazz, he had his own sound. He was a little bit influenced by Django Reinhardt. In fact, he was just about the only American guitarist who was, say in the 40s. But he also had his own country twang to it, and he was a fine player.
In 1943, he moved to Hollywood and formed a new trio, and then he also worked with Bing Crosby, too. By the way, I'm mentioning this. The only way I know all of this information is from reading this book. I want to plug your book whenever possible. It's that good. How did he meet Mary Ford? How did they get together?
I believe he had tryouts for singers. You know, he wanted to do something with a singer, and he heard her, and she was a country singer who was not at all known at the time. She was just starting out, so he just saw something in her.
Now, I remember this. He had a show on radio and television. And in 1984, he started something really pretty interesting. He began playing every Monday night at Fat Tuesdays in New York. Why did he do that? He just decided he wanted to get out and play?
I think it was also good for his health, too, because he was having trouble with arthritis in his hands. And the doctor said, well, you should play guitar more. And he hadn't been playing that much in public for, say, 10 years before that. So he started doing that, and he just enjoyed it.
Now, who, for you, were the significant jazz guitarists of the 1960s?
Of the 60s? Well, Wes Montgomery is the best known one, and mm-hmm. he was the most popular. And, you know, he probably brought the Charlie Christian style to its height, in a way. And George Benson was the biggest new discovery. And Grant Green was a brilliant player who was unusual for guitarists in that he hardly ever hit a chord. He played almost everything single note lines.
And what about somebody I forgot to talk about from the 50s, Joe Pass, another great guitarist. Solo bop guitar. You describe him as the ultimate bebop guitarist, which is that's not an instrument you usually associate with bebop.
The thing about Joe Pass is he could play unaccompanied solos. He really mastered that, particularly by the 70s. So he could play a song like Cherokee or How High the Moon up tempo, and you would hear not only his solo, but you'd hear the chords, you'd hear bass lines, and you'd hear harmonies, and he'd just be doing that on a conventional guitar.
Now, John McLaughlin, you got to talk about him. Talk about John McLaughlin, because, I got to see him play a lot back in the late 60s, early 70s with the Maya Vishnu Orchestra, and talk to me about it. You described that he changed the way guitar is played in jazz. How?
Well, up to that point in time, say from 1940 to late 60s, pretty much every guitarist sort of sounded like a relative of Charlie Christian. But John McLaughlin didn't. He had his own sound. He brought in the influence of rock and folk music and world music into jazz. But he was also a great virtuoso, and I would consider him a jazz guitarist, even though sometimes his sound would make people think he's a rock guitarist. He was kind of in between, but he had the abilities of a jazz musician. It still does. He could play anything.
You're old enough to remember him back in the 60s and 70s. People bought his records as rock albums.
Yeah, well, the Maya Vishnu Orchestra sounded like a rock group. It had the volume, it had the instruments. But then again, they were jamming for 10, 15 minutes on songs.
That's right.
and they weren't just playing a melody over and over again. They were playing very complex music. I would think of him as a jazz person who could also be considered a rock guitarist. And ever since that time, that was really like the guitarist, a third battle. You know, the guitar battled to be in jazz, and then a battle to be heard. And with John McLaughlin, won the battle to be its own individual instrument and not just sound like Django Reinhardt or Charlie Christian. Because after John McLaughlin, a lot of different guitar stylists have come up, and they all sound different from each other.
Now, he blended jazz with Indian classical music, too, which he has to have been one of the first people to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially at that level, because he was playing Indian classical music on its own terms with Shakti.
Wow. Now, the list of the top 30 jazz guitar greats, not only do you do this list, the big grand list, you have a shortened list. When you go to do lists like this, Scott, how difficult is it to sort of whittle it down to 30? It has to be hard. How and where are you making the cuts?
Well, you know, I start out with a list of everything, everybody who's...
Okay, that's the book.
The 342, and then once I get from that, then I just look at it and know which guitarists are the most individual, which had the biggest influences, and which are the most brilliant players. And pretty quickly, I got it down to about 50, and then cutting it from 50 to 30 is the hardest part.
No, but why didn't you leave it at 50?
Well, I think it was some number like 47. And
you wanted an even number.
You know, and also I didn't want it to be an endless list. I wanted it to be a little smaller.
Talk to me about that list. Who's at the top of your list? If you were to talk about who the greatest jazz, let's talk about the top 10 in your and rated as the top 10. Who would they be? And let's talk about each of them individually.
Well, of course, that's tricky, and I'm just getting this out of my head. Basically, I mean, Django Reinhardt's my favorite guitarist.
Now, why?
Oh, the ones that are alive? Okay.
No, I said why? Why?
Oh, right.
I want you to talk about your personal. And again, everybody's going to realize this is your personal list. So we're listening to your reasons for why. Why Django Reinhardt?
Well, he had his own sound. You could tell it's him in two or three notes. He mastered the acoustic guitar, and he was in the 30s, just far ahead of everybody else. He was just very advanced. But also, I always love the fact that he also mastered the electric guitar 15 years later, and so it's like he was a giant on two different levels because of that.
Now, what would be number two, though?
Well, this is just like I say out of my head. I mean, Charlie Christian because he invented so many of the lines he came up with, and was just such a major influence on so many others.
Now, when you were writing about jazz, when you first started to write about jazz in the 1970s, who was the first jazz guitarist that struck you as being a great jazz guitarist in the beginning part of your career? I realize that's a long time ago.
Well, I'm just trying to think because I wasn't necessarily listening to guitars that much. George Benson I caught early on. Yeah, I knew he was great.
Well, I mean, was guitar a hard sell for you as an instrument for jazz in the beginning?
No. the guitar wasn't really considered all that major. It was when you listen to fusion groups, but if you go back to, that's what's unusual about the instrument. You can go back, say, before 1970, a lot of the major and most important jazz groups didn't even have a guitar. You know, say the John Coltrane Quartet.
Yeah, yeah.
Any of the Miles Davis groups, and Benny Goodman Quartet, Louis Armstrong Hot Five, they had a banjo, but I mean, a lot of times the guitar wasn't really part of it. It was still looking for its niche. So I never had any trouble getting into the guitar. And then, once I was able to get into someone like John McLaughlin or Pat Metheny, those two I put very high in the history. Then I was open to the guitar as an improvising instrument.
Now, Scott, I want to talk to you about your long career, which is amazingly impressive. And everybody knows your name from the writing. How did this start? How did you begin to write about jazz and not just appreciate and listen to jazz? What were your first gigs?
Well, I was lucky in that I had a friend, Brian Ashley, who started a magazine called Record Review, and that started in 1976. And the idea behind the magazine was for it to be a third jazz, a third rock, and a third classical. And over a period of time, it started off like that. Over a period of time, the classical dropped out, and the rock became mostly heavy metal. So it became the world's only heavy metal and jazz magazine.
And what?
I started at the top, really, and worked my way down.
But talk to me about writing about jazz, because writing about music is some of the most difficult writing in the world. Did you have role models that you tried to model your reviews after?
Nobody really closely. I would read as much as possible, and there were some writers who I liked. I mean, early on, I remember reading a lot Leonard Feather and Nat Hentoff and Ralph Gleason.
Okay.
Those were the three. And then after a period of time, I realized that Whitney Ballier might have been the best of all of them as far as just being able to describe the music. And you could read his articles, and you could actually hear the music in your mind from what he wrote. But I didn't really model myself after any of them so much, except to maybe learn from their mistakes and just say, well, I'm not going to do this.
I have to also talk to you about liner notes, which is a particular kind of writing. What are you trying to accomplish when you write liner notes? I mean, you've penned 750 sets of liner notes, which I think is a major accomplishment in and of itself. But what are you trying to accomplish with liner notes? And by the way, I used to love albums, not CDs or MP3s or whatever, because you could sit there and read the liner notes.
I know. I still go to used record stores and look for albums, so yes, I know.
I mean, and part of that were people like you writing, because there was a whole, and people today do not understand how important that is. But what is your attitude towards writing a liner note? What makes a good liner note?
Well, you want to tell the story behind the album, the story behind the sessions, really. And then you give some background as far as the artist goes, particularly if it's someone new or if it's someone who has a really interesting story. You want to give readers you're sort of giving readers a bonus now, just letting them know a little bit about the musicians. But really, it's just what's the story of the record and what are they trying to do?
Now, you've reviewed more jazz CDs than anyone in history. Have there been reviews that you've not wanted to write because they'd be so negative?
Not too many. Most of the time I get to pick what I want.
That's well, I would think so by this time in your career.
Some magazines they assign it to you. It really depends, but no, I mean I'll be if someone's coming out with an album and it's not any good and they're charging $15, I should tell people that. But on the other hand, it shouldn't just be my opinion. I should really, and any reviewer should just really just be describing the music and giving enough hints so the reader will know whether they're going to like the record or not. Because there are things that I like that they may not, or vice versa.
Now, do you still find it because you've written so many things in jazz over so many years, is it difficult to come up with a fresh angle?
No, it might be not a fresh angle. It might be difficult to come up with a fresh phrase. You know, you run out of words after a while. You know, I don't want to repeat myself too often, even though repeating itself when you do a large quantity is impossible to avoid. But no, it's just what does it sound like when it gets down to it? You know, describe the music. You can't really be as valuable as actually listening to the record, but
right.
You can at least give them a lot of clues. Give readers a lot of clues.
Now, I'm fascinated by jazz and film. What is your, for you, not just jazz guitar, of which there's a list here, what's your favorite jazz film? Not a documentary, but favorite jazz film that features jazz musicians?
Well, that's tricky, you know, because, the best jazz films are probably something like The Sound of Jazz or
right.
or Jazz on a Summer's Day, where they actually have performances of jazz musicians, and they happen to be very inspired.
A fictional
ones?
Yeah.
Well, Round Midnight has its moments.
Yes.
You know, that's actually fairly realistic, even though it's a little bit downbeat. The movie that really got me started in jazz altogether was The Five Pennies.
Excellent.
The Danny Kaye movie.
Yeah.
The 1959 with Louis Armstrong in it, just because it has the joy of the music. I mean, it's basically fictional, but it's such great fun to watch.
He plays Red Nichols.
Yeah.
Excellent. It's a fine film.
I mean, there's a couple of scenes in that are just really classic.
Scott, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, and I admire your writing tremendously.
Oh, thanks. Well, I appreciate being on, and it's always fun to talk about the music.
It is. My guest tonight has been Scott Yanna, who has been writing about jazz since 1975. For all the major jazz magazines, he's penned 750 sets of liner notes and reviewed more jazz CDs than anyone in history. And been talking about his book, which should be on everybody's table, The Great Jazz Guitarist, The Ultimate Guide. Scott, as always, a pleasure.
Thanks for helping keep jazz on the radio.
Thank you so much. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.